Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and this is the Climate Cast In-Depth. Once a month, Paul Huttner and I turn the Climate Cast into an hour-long show. Later in the hour, we're going to meet a climate scientist in the field who studies human migration as a result of climate change. But we're beginning with Michael Mann, a professor of meteorology who's authored a visual guide that helps us understand how the climate is changing. Paul Huttner's with me in the studio. Paul, welcome.
Good morning, Carrie.
Before Michael joins us, I have to say, I want to say how refreshing and well executed I think this book is. And as I was saying to you off air, it is, there's lots of statistics, there's plenty of data, there's a lot of science, but it's very consumable.
It is. It's accessible. You know, one of the key challenges of communicating climate science is accessibility, making this complex science easy to understand. The book, I think, Carrie, has solid science and also some dire predictions. Of course, that's the big title. He kind of war games out different climate change scenarios, which I find interesting and valuable. But it also trends a little bit towards solutions, and important, I think that's important in keeping a sense of hope and encouraging action on climate change.
Yeah, I want to say for the title, Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, would be potentially off-putting to people who say, I don't want to think about that, but you get into it.
Right.
And you see the relevance of the forest fire season that we've had out in California, mm-hmm. the flooding that we had in South Carolina, and then it becomes kind of real to your environment.
It does. I mean, the attribution is a growing area of climate science, attributing what component of these extreme weather events can be attributed to climate change. This book takes a stab at that. It's also got great graphics and charts and science in it. I mean, this would make a great eighth grade earth science textbook, and I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah.
It's very accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. So as Michael Mann is going to join us here in just a second, we're matching up the latest research with some of the scientific basics about climate change, and it's a great opportunity for you listening today to ask a question that has always puzzled you or intrigued you or, you know, challenged you about climate change. All questions are welcome as long as they come from true curiosity, okay? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Something that you've always wondered about climate change, that you've observed in your own environment. You're looking at some of the statistics. You're curious about how that fits with other information that you've heard about this. We welcome all questions, and as I say, as long as they come from a place of true curiosity. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet me, at @CarrieNPR. Steph Curtis is hanging out at nprnews.org. Michael Mann is a professor of meteorology at Penn State, where he's director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. He's co-author of the new book, Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, and he's with us from State College, Pennsylvania. Michael, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be with both of you.
What'd you think about Paul's and my read on the book and what it's good for?
Well, I was delighted by your assessment. You know, we really did want to produce something that was accessible to the lay public. Too often, science, whether it be the science of climate change or science in any field, can be impenetrable. Sometimes scientists like myself make the mistake of using too much jargon and lingo and technical terms that we don't define. But this is an issue. Climate change is an issue that we all need to understand because it really is perhaps the greatest challenge that we face today. And so I think it's incumbent upon scientists and science communicators to really make an effort to convey the science and its implications in basic terms. And that's what we sought to do with the book. As you note, as Paul mentioned, while you know we do go into some of the dire potential predictions, some of the bad things that are already happening and worse things that could happen if we don't act, we spend quite a bit of space and time in the book talking about solutions, because there's a feel-good story to be told there. There are so many things that are happening right now with respect to the, you know, the ramping up of renewable technology, the transition to a green energy economy, including here in the U.S., the fact that carbon emissions didn't grow last year. For the first time, we had economic growth without any growth in carbon emissions, and mm-hmm. that suggests we're starting to turn the corner. So there are reasons for cautious optimism here as well. But there's certainly a great urgency of action. And we did our best to try to communicate all of that in a way.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. You know, Michael, we're getting some good calls in here.
Yeah.
And I think this goes right to kind of what I wanted to do with the show. So let's hear from some of our listeners about their questions. To Cassandra in St. Cloud. Hey, Cassandra, thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Yeah. Hey, what's your question?
My fiance and I are always arguing about a really kind of basic thing about climate change, and that is that whether or not there is a cause by man in regard to that. And I'm just wondering what his take might be on that.
Cassandra, does your fiance tend to say he buys into the idea of climate change, but it's a natural cycle and man wasn't involved in it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. Michael, what's her argument back to that? And we hear this a lot from other listeners.
Yeah, I hear that argument a lot as well. And to me, sometimes it sort of sounds like, an arsonist, throws a match and starts a forest fire. And his defense is, hey, forest fires happen naturally anyways. And so just because climate has varied in the past for natural reasons, has no bearing on why it's changing today. And to really appreciate the fundamental difference, you have to look at the rates of change that we're talking about, because there's no question. You can go back, hundreds of millions of years in time. If you go back about 100 million years in time, you're sort of in the early part of the Cretaceous. CO2 levels were naturally very high at that point, very high greenhouse gas concentrations, and the globe was probably warmer than it is today. But that's because of changes in these greenhouse gas concentrations that are driven naturally on timescales of literally hundreds of millions of years. What we're essentially doing is taking all of the carbon that was in the atmosphere. It eventually got buried beneath Earth's surface by natural processes, what we call fossil fuels. And we're taking all that carbon that got buried over 100 million years, we're releasing it in less than 100 years. And that is leading to rates of change in the composition of our atmosphere, warming of the planet, and rapid changes in rainfall patterns and drought patterns and impacts on hurricane intensity, changes that are just happening too fast for the adaptive capacity of living things, including ourselves.
Okay.
When it happens over 100 million years, you can adapt to it. When it happens over 100 years and you have the sort of societal infrastructure that we depend on today to support 7 billion people on the planet, it creates havoc.
Yeah, what I want to do here, Paul, is also, because Cassandra lives where we do, to say, here's a observable things that you can use in your rebuttal, in your argument to your fiance about it.
Yeah, climate change in Minnesota is not an abstract concept.
Right.
It is measurable. The metrics here, we use something called 30-year averages, and those 30-year averages have been warming pretty rapidly here. So climate change is happening in our lifetime. If you look at winters in Minnesota, that's where the biggest signal is. We are warming at the rate of 11 degrees per century in winter now. So by the end of this century, a Minnesota that's 11 degrees warmer in winter than it is today. That's a different kind of Minnesota. So we're seeing that in our growing seasons, in the things that grow in Minnesota, and we're seeing that in the numbers, not a climate model of the future, but the actual numbers that we've already observed.
And again, as Michael said, it's the acceleration of the pace of the changes that tells us how human activity is influencing this.
It is. And Michael may be able to elaborate on this, but I also believe you can detect which CO2 molecules in the atmosphere were caused naturally versus man-made. Michael, do you have any perspective on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We know the CO2 that's building up in the atmosphere. Well, it's building up at an unprecedented rate. It's higher now than it's been in millions of years. So that's suggestive that we're the culprit. But there's actually a fingerprint that literally convicts us as the culprit. And it is in the CO2 molecules, the relative composition of the carbon atom. There are different stable isotopes of carbon. There's carbon-12 and carbon-14. Or carbon-13, rather. And the ratio of those isotopes is different for CO2 that's produced from fossil fuel burning and CO2 that's produced naturally. And so when we actually measure the CO2 that's building up in the atmosphere, we can see it has the fingerprint of fossil fuel burning. I wanted to comment on one other thing that Paul mentioned, which I think is absolutely right. Climate change has often been presented you know, as an abstract sort of entity, something that will impact polar bears, you know, in decades up in the Arctic. And when it's presented that way, unfortunately, it makes it feel very distant when, in fact, we are feeling the impacts of climate change now where we live. And I remember being up in Minnesota just a couple years ago. And I was talking with some folks who do ice fishing, and they said they're really seeing the impact, that there's a shorter and shorter season for ice fishing because of these warm winters, and it really is making a difference. You know, it's something, it's almost part of the culture of the state, and it's something that we're losing, and that's true everywhere. There's things about our culture that we're losing as climate is changing in an abrupt way.
Paul, think about some of the sled dog races that have had, I mean, just even when Michael talks about culture, that's what I think of. The culture of winter around here is different.
It is, and the resort business in Minnesota is feeling that as well. I'm already getting phone calls and emails concerned about this winter because we're headed into a monster El Nino here that trends milder on average in Minnesota. It's not a slam dunk, but 75% or so milder than average winters. Resorts are concerned about temperatures and snowfall, obviously. You know, Michael, I want to get to some of the solutions in your book later, but first it is titled Dire Predictions. And I'm interested in this linkage between the longer-term tapestry of climate change and when climate change suddenly becomes news before our eyes. A couple of examples from the book, page 138, Climate Change and War and Climate Refugees. What are your what's your take on some reports have drawn linkages to the Syrian conflict and drought there, the refugee waves into Europe, things like that, things like the 1,000-year-plus rains with South Carolina over the past couple of weeks here. Take us into when climate change becomes news and how we attribute that.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. There are things that we see happening in the world today where climate change is absolutely part of the story, whether it's the unprecedented drought that California is facing right now, that 1,000-year rainfall event you just referred to in South Carolina, where a piece of it, you know, weather happens naturally, heavy rainfalls, flooding happen naturally, but there was one ingredient there which we can tie to climate change. Ocean temperatures off the east coast of the U.S. In the tropical Atlantic there were at record levels when Joaquin strengthened and intensified very rapidly over those warm waters. And it also had much more moisture in the air because the warmer the ocean surface, the more moisture it evaporates into the atmosphere. And so there were record levels of moisture that were available to add to that stalled frontal system that was already producing heavy rainfall itself. And you can see in the satellite images, you can actually see the moisture that was streaming in from Joaquin into that region. In fact, Stephen Colbert did a somewhat funny but you know, segment about it. Of course, it was a tragedy, but it was remarkable how things sort of came together to yield that very unusual event. And it's the sort of thing we've been saying it's going to become more common as oceans warm, as certain types of storms like these tend to intensify, and we're seeing it play out. I wanted to comment also on the Syrian uprising. So the national security dimensions of climate change are another excellent example of where we really are seeing the rubber hit the road. And I have the luxury here at Penn State. We have one of the leaders in that entire area, David Titley, Rear Admiral David Titley, who used to be the oceanographer for the Navy and was tasked with helping the Navy deal with the national security implications of climate change. And, you know, the Navy, other national security leaders have gone on record saying this is potentially the greatest national security threat that we face in the years and decades ahead, because we see growing global population on a collision course with decreased food, water, and land, all of that being made more of a challenge by climate change. And it gives sort of a perfect storm, if you will, for, you know, global conflict. And some have pointed out, I think, quite that there's quite a clear connection with the Syrian uprising. What you had was an unprecedented drought where climate change is probably playing a role, making it worse, and that led to urban farmers moving into rural farmers moving into the urban regions, which created more competition, more conflict within the cities. And so climate change, if you talk to national security leaders, will tell you, seems to have been one of the underlying factors
this
that contributed to that.
We always do a climate scientist in the field as part of our hour-long in-depth on the ClimateCast, and I'll be talking with Andrea Milan, who is looking at what's happening in Syria as he studies human migration and climate change. If you've just tuned in, Michael Mann is with us this morning. He's our guest for our hour-long in-depth climate cast, and he is a professor of meteorology at Penn State, and we're talking about his newest book. It's called Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change. And I'm thinking, Paul and I are thinking about this show as a chance for you to ask some of the most puzzling or challenging questions that come up for you around climate change, because the book is full of great data and statistics, but as Paul noted, very accessible. So it will answer a lot of those questions, and we have Michael with us, and we have Paul with us to answer some of your questions about that. What puzzles you about the information that you hear about climate change? Are you in a debate with somebody in your family, and you'll be seeing them at Thanksgiving, and you want a little ammunition? This is the place to get that. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, where Kathy says, my dad in California has a well that's gone dry, and he can't get someone to dig a new one. He may have to abandon his home. It is real. Steph off the page.
Jeff is asking, aren't we due for an ice age relatively soon based on the ice age cycle?
Michael, is that true?
So the ice ages come and go on timescales of tens of thousands of years, and it is true that we would slowly be descending, very slightly, at a fraction of a degree per year into the next ice age if it were entirely natural factors that that were at the helm of the climate system. But instead, what human beings did arguably thousands of years ago, a good friend and colleague of mine, Bill Ruddeman, formerly from the University of Virginia, wrote a book, Plows, Petroleum, and Plagues, where he made a very credible case that we had already sort of taken hold of the climate 6,000 years ago with agriculture, and other human disturbances in the land, in the Earth's surface. We were already putting enough CO2 and methane into the atmosphere that we were diverting the climate from its the course it otherwise would have taken. So we thwarted that slow descent into an ice age thousands of years ago, and now we've completely taken hold of that control knob. Our hand is firmly on the CO2 control knob, and we're turning it up, and the climate is responding and warming and changing as a result.
So, Michael, while we're talking about ages here, there's a place in the book, and I've got it open and I'm looking for it, where you call this the Anthropocene age. Is this how you think scientists and historians will look back and describe the age that we're in?
I think so, and that term was actually coined, I believe, by Sherry Rowland, who was won the Nobel Prize in chemistry decades ago for his contribution to our understanding of the ozone hole.
Uh-huh.
He was a wonderful scientist and a wonderful science communicator, and I'm so sorry he's no longer with us. But he coined that term, and I think it's appropriate, because what it says, by using a term like Anthropocene, what we're saying is our impact on the planet is now so profound that it is on a par with the great geological periods of the past, the Cretaceous, the Jurassic. But this period didn't emerge over millions of years. This period we created over thousands and, less than 1,000 years, and arguably the true emergence of the Anthropocene is really only the past century. So we are having such a profound impact on the planet that we put the Earth into a new geological period on a time scale of just centuries, whereas nature has taken millions of years to do that.
All right. Question for you from Mark in Forest Lake. Hey, Mark. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
As a young boy, I spent my summers at a cabin up in northern Minnesota, just south of Duluth, near Moose Lake, about 40 miles south of Duluth. And it seemed to me back then the prevailing winds came from the northwest, And south winds were fairly rare, maybe a couple times a month, and they always brought strong winds and big waves. Yeah. And northeast winds always brought, or seemed to bring, sort of low skies, drizzle, cool temperatures. Now, it seems to me as though south winds are much more prevalent, and those northeast winds bring beautiful weather. So what I'm wondering is, has climate change brought about change in wind direction?
Paul,
thank you.
Paul, I want to ask you first if you've observed the same thing in our area.
Yeah, I think over time that is happening. I'd have to go back and look at some of the Windrose data, which averages winds over a year or a season to look at that. But Michael, I've been getting this question a lot too, and I'm wondering your take on how climate change is affecting wind direction.
Well, it's a great question, and without sort of having focused on the details of what's happening climatically in that region, I'm speaking somewhat off the cuff here, but I can imagine there are a few things going on. First of all, there is an interesting discussion, and I know, Paul, we had this discussion some months ago in a former program about the potential impact that the melting of Arctic sea ice might be having on the jet stream. And that's an area of active debate within the scientific community. The rapid loss of sea ice from the Arctic is allowing a lot of heat to escape from the Arctic Ocean into the atmosphere in the fall and early winter, enough heat that it may literally change the direction and strength of the jet stream. And some scientists have speculated that we are seeing that in some of the very unusual large-scale storm patterns that we've had in the U.S. that we've seen in the United States in recent years, the cold air outbreaks in the east balanced by record warmth in the Arctic, and the jet stream veering north of California and depriving it of that moisture, all part of a fairly unusual atmospheric circulation pattern that's become somewhat more prominent. But you also have, in general, less ice over the lakes, and I imagine that has impacted lake effect, weather-related conditions in this region of the country. Although precisely how that plays out depends on what season you're talking about, and obviously there's a lot of year-to-year variation. I think actually there've been some pretty heavy lake ice conditions in some recent winters because of those cold air outbreaks that we've seen in the east.
Paul,
so it's pretty complicated, but it would be surprising if those things were not changing given the way that the larger climate system is changing.
Paul, I wanted to remind listeners here of something that you were talking about when Hurricane Joaquin was forming and coming up the coast. You were talking about how climate change may not have affected the creation of that hurricane, but it affected the intensity of it, and you could watch that in real time.
Yeah, and that goes back to what Michael was talking about with the record ocean temperatures in the Atlantic. Hurricanes feed on warm ocean water, and once you get into an environment with little wind shear and very warm ocean waters, that's a very favorable environment for hurricanes to intensify. And this kind of intensification that we're seeing with storms like Joaquin, where they hit these intense warm water bubbles, is extremely rapid and very hard to forecast, I might add, from the National Hurricane Center. We're better at forecasting carry hurricane tracks than we are at fluctuations in intensity. So one of, I think, the unknown unknowns of climate change is, what will this do to the intensification process of hurricanes? Is that going to quicken it and speed it up? And then how does that affect us going forward from a forecast and a damage standpoint should they make landfall?
And would you say that even in our area, you have seen indications of how that intensification changes the character of a predicted storm?
The weather maps are changing. I've been looking at weather maps every day for about 30 years. And if you talk to people like Jennifer Francis at Rutgers, who is doing these studies on changes in the Arctic and how it affects the jet stream, at some point those changes work themselves down to our daily weather. And so one of the unknown unknowns, I think, is how quickly are climate changes affecting the jet stream and affecting our daily weather patterns. We're getting more blocking patterns. We're getting more stuck weather systems. There's some documentation to show that. And that translates into changes in our daily weather that add up to climate change over the long time. So this isn't just a climate thing. It becomes a meteorology thing.
Right.
At some point, the question is how fast and what will the precise impacts be regionally?
There's a quick question for you about the El Nino, since you've been watching this, Paul, from Roger. He says that he heard that the last El Nino came across the country was 1998. What did the weather look like in the upper Midwest then? Have you looked at that?
I have. It wasn't the last El Nino, but it was the event of record, the so-called climate event of the century. It's the strongest El Nino event on record.
Okay.
And during that winter in Minnesota, it was 11 degrees warmer than average during meteorological winter.
That was the average.
That was
wow.
the average. 11 degrees warmer. The other big El Nino, 82, 83, we were 8 degrees warmer. So there's a high likelihood of a milder than average winter with less than average snowfall in Minnesota this winter, maybe about 75 to 80%. Not a slam dunk, but a very high probability.
Okay. To the phones, we have full phone lines here, so I want to go back to listeners' questions here. To Doug in St. Paul. Hi, Doug. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. I have a question about the shortage of water in the Southwest and, the, and the problem they're having there. How does that relate to climate change, and what's going to happen to 65 million people when they run out of water?
Michael?
Yeah, well, it's the $64,000 question, isn't it? You know, Paul sort of alluded to this. There is some evidence that we are seeing changes in the meanders of the jet stream. The jet stream sort of getting stuck into a particular blocking pattern. And again, there has been some scientific work potentially linking that to the decrease in sea ice in the Arctic. So there may be a climate change connection there. But that particular pattern, that same pattern that's given us some cold winters back east, has given us record warmth in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, and it's caused the jet stream to veer north of California and deprived California of that moisture. Now, there is a debate within the scientific community about the precise role that climate change has had in creating that pattern that leads the jet stream north of California, leads to a decrease in the rainfall in California and the snowfall that builds up their snowpack. But what we know for certain is that the unusually warm temperatures that California has seen, last year was the warmest year on record for California, that certainly meant that not only did you have less rainfall because of the lack of storms coming into the region, but you had more loss of whatever moisture there is in the soil through evaporation. The warmer the soils, the more evaporation of what moisture they do have. On top of that, you had little, if any, snowpack because of those very warm winters, and that means that in the spring you don't have that melt runoff that provides California with critical water resources during the dry time of the year. So all those factors came together to, you know, once again give us sort of a perfect storm of consequences that created a drought in California that's unprecedented, the paleoclimate folks tell us, for at least 1,200 years.
Michael, that's a great point. I just want to jump in on that real quick before we move on too long, because I spent 9 years in Tucson, Arizona, which is, of course, fed by the Colorado River, as our many other southwestern cities. And the assumptions that they made for the flows when they built the Hoover Dam and in the 20s and 30s were based on one of the wettest decades for snowpack in the Colorado and the Southwest. So the assumption, this is a really important part about climate change, an important point. The assumptions that we've made with our infrastructure for certain climates no longer apply in many cases. And we're not seeing that kind of snowpack to deliver that runoff in the Southwest that we were when those dams were built in the 20s and 30s.
Paul, a tweet here, and this is something that you talk about. What can one do at an individual level to help combat climate change? And then I think we have a call here, I thought, from Diane in Chaska. And I think this goes towards that, too. So let's listen to what she wants to know. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hey, what do you want to ask?
I have two questions. One, I had read somewhere that a scientist in Europe had said that if we would make our roofs white instead of the dark colors that they are, we could impact the temperature across the world.
Uh-huh.
And then secondly, is there a method with what we know about CO2 to create microclimates in different areas of the world to impact the droughts and the various weather conditions?
Okay. Michael, first to this idea that individuals can make a difference, and to the, I think she's citing research that says if everybody painted their roofs white instead of black, maybe that'd make a difference, would it?
Well, you know, actually, our presidential science advisor, who's a leading climate scientist or has expertise in that area, John Holdren, actually commented on this a few years ago when he was asked about the things that people can do themselves on a voluntary basis to try to help out. And, yeah, there are things like that. It turns out it makes a small dent, but there is no magic bullet. If we're going to prevent CO2 levels from reaching, you know, truly dangerous levels of climate change, irreversible climate change, we're going to need to act on all cylinders, basically. And that means being more efficient with our use of energy. It means transitioning away from our reliance on fossil fuel energy towards renewable energy. And it means taking part in all those voluntary measures that we can take part in to reduce our own individual carbon footprints. And there are, you know, ways you can contribute to that. Painting your roof white, you know, certainly can help a little bit. But more importantly, it means reducing your energy usage, using more, you know, fuel efficient vehicles, electric cars, and plug-in hybrids are ramping up in production in the U.S.
So Michael, I hear you saying it isn't, well, we're just going to have to let the people at the government level, the policymakers, solve this. I mean, you are encouraging that individuals can do something.
Yeah, let me be clear. We have to do both.
Okay.
So we have to do those sort of non-regrets things that we can do that'll help out anyways, and we have to put pressure on our policymakers to reflect our interests rather than the special interests that tend to fund their campaigns by passing policies at the national level and the state level and the municipal level to incentivize that transition that's already underway. We're already turning the corner, moving towards green energy, renewable energy. That's just the natural evolution as we get past antiquated energy technology. But we have to accelerate that transition if we're going to keep climate change from reaching ever more dangerous levels. And to do that, we need to incentivize renewable energy. We need to put a price on the emission of carbon that takes into account the damage that it does to the planet.
Okay.
And that'll help.
Michael, I'm interested in the pace of that change. We try to talk about solutions here on climate change, and you highlighted some of the positive trends that we're already seeing.
Yeah.
Greenhouse gas emissions seem to be stabilizing. The decline in the coal industry, I think, is kind of remarkable. Clean energy jobs, we're seeing those increase right here in Minnesota. We've got over 15,000 clean energy jobs, and they pay. The average, I think, is something like $71,000 a year. Talk a little bit about climate change as an economic opportunity. Some have called it maybe the next moonshot as we transition to a clean energy economy. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. And people have compared this to, you know, the Apollo project, that we need a, you know, international, basically, reimagining of our global energy economy. We need to remake our energy economy in a way that provides us the energy we need for a growing global population without degrading our planet. And there are ways to do that. And the amazing thing is that China, you know, the largest emitter of carbon, even larger emitter of carbon than the U.S., is now moving ahead of the U.S. when it comes to renewable energy technology, when it comes to putting a price on the emission of carbon to help their own market incentivize renewable energy internally. They're taking all those measures themselves voluntarily without international pressure because they know that's the best thing for their citizenry. They know that that's what's going to lead them into the 21st century economy. The 21st century economy is going to be a renewable energy economy. And those countries that already recognize that and are moving forward are going to be in the lead. We risk falling behind in terms of our international competitiveness if we don't get into the fray now. And so really this is about not only preserving the planet, but preserving the health of our economy and not falling behind the rest of the world as it moves forward.
If you have just tuned into the conversation here, Paul Huttner and I are doing our hour-long climate cast as we do once a month. A little later, we're going to talk with our climate scientist in the field, and he studies human migration and climate change, so he'll join us a bit later. But Michael Mann is with us now. He's a professor of meteorology at Penn State and the author of a book we're talking about, Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change. Steph, a question off the page here?
Yeah, this is a comment actually from Jerry. He says, living here in California, we're getting warm winter storms, not the cold that's needed to pack the Sierra. And environmentalists here have fought tooth and nail to prevent new dams to catch the rain. I feel like we're cutting off our nose to spite our face every turn in the road.
Is that some of the concern with, I hear analysts in California saying, yes, we've got this El Nino, and yes, it's going to bring more rain, but it may not solve a lot of the problems that we have. Is that part of the reason why?
Well, you know, I think Paul and I could probably geek out on this El Nino for the entire session.
Absolutely. Oh, I know Paul could.
But it provides a fascinating laboratory. I mean, speaking as a science geek, this is an amazing laboratory. This El Nino is shaping up to be a monumental El Nino, and that means it's a huge climate signal. We can learn so much from understanding how regional patterns of rainfall and temperature respond to this huge El Nino event that can actually inform our understanding of aspects of climate change. And so climate scientists are very interested in seeing how this El Nino plays out. Is it, you know, the closest analog, as Paul said, to what we're seeing now is the 1997-98 El Nino event, a mega El Nino event, the El Nino of the century, at least for that century. We'll see what happens here. And it did end up alleviating the drought problem that California was experiencing at the time. Not El Niños are the same. Even similar-looking El Niños don't always lead to precisely the same impact on the jet stream.
That's interesting.
So we're all watching with great interest to see, will this help out with the California drought? We are seeing it actually dampening the Atlantic hurricane season a bit, even though we did have, you know, a couple big storms, and most recently Joaquin. There have only been 10 named storms, and there's been very little activity over the last week or so. That's a relatively inactive Atlantic hurricane season, But we're seeing a very active Pacific hurricane season.
Paul,
and that's
you were
going
to say.
Yeah, I wanted to circle back quickly to the California drought and the El Nino this winter. One of the things we watch in the West very closely are snow levels. How high, what elevation is the snow level on the mountains? 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 feet. When the snow, if climate change may be producing higher snow levels, which means less of the mountains are getting snow to accumulate and more of the lower elevations or mid elevations are getting rain. That does not help as much with drought because you need that stored snowpack to be able to then slowly melt in spring and fill those reservoirs in spring and into summer to sustain that water supply.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that is happening is we're getting warmer springs and that snow is actually evaporating some of it before it melts and runs off, and it's there's less there available. So how low will the snow line be? That's one sub-thread you can watch in California this winter.
Michael, thank you very much for the time today, and we have so many questions that we didn't answer that I think Paul and I will do another session where we just take open-ended questions. So thank you for helping us with this today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
An hour is never enough with you, Michael. Thanks so much.
Thanks, folks.
Michael Mann's book is called Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change. Yeah, Paul, questions coming in here about agriculture and livestock raising and population. I think this is something that we have to do again, where we just kind of invite a guest in and then open it up for questions that are puzzling or, you know, intriguing.
It is,
to
you know, and
listeners.
Terry, I sense a shift here in the nature of the thinking and questions on climate change that when you and I started this project almost 3 years ago now, we're way past, is climate change real? Is it happening? Now we're into, it is real. It's happening. What are the effects and consequences? And how does this play out? And I think sort of this war gaming of what's going to happen in different regions with climate shifts is very important, and it's something that they're doing, as Michael said, at the national security level. So it's not just a bunch of science geeks sitting around in a room anymore.
We're going to talk with our climate scientist in the field, and then at the end of the hour, I'll ask Paul about some of the other climate news that he's been watching. All that ahead. First, a look at the latest news. And Phil, what are you watching this morning in the newsroom?
Hi, Carrie. President Obama plans to announce this morning that some 5,500 U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan when he leaves office in 2017. That's according to senior administration officials. Obama had originally planned to pull out all but a small embassy-based U.S. military presence by the end of next year. But military leaders have argued for months that Afghans need more support in beating back a resurgent Taliban. An advocate for the elderly says they're facing another blow to their retirement income. Mary Johnson of the Senior Citizens League reacted to the news there will be no benefits increased for the tens of millions of people receiving Social Security or for disabled veterans or federal retirees. Their benefits are tied to the government's measure of inflation at the consumer level, and because of falling gas prices, prices overall have remained the same over the past year. Not counting gasoline, prices are up 1.9% during that time. The number of people applying for unemployment aid has now matched its lowest level in 42 years. It's strong evidence employers are confident enough in the economy to hold on to their staffs. The Labor Department has applications fell 7,000 last week to a seasonally adjusted 255,000. The World Health Organization says it's possible for patients who survived Ebola to develop the lethal disease again. The WHO says in rare cases, the virus can linger in the body and start to replicate. That might explain why what has happened to a Scottish nurse now being treated in London. Pauline Kafferke was admitted on Friday for an unusual late complication of Ebola. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Universal Pictures, presenting Steve Jobs, the new film from the screenwriter of The Social Network and the director of Slumdog Millionaire, now playing in select theaters everywhere October 23rd.
ClimateCast is supported by Benjamin Franklin Plumbing, specializing in all types of boiler, hydronic, and radiator heating systems, also specializing in drain repair. Live operators are available 24 hours a day. BenFranklinPlumbing.com, the punctual plumbers.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by the Carolyn Foundation, working to support clean energy systems across the Upper Midwest. More information is available online at carolynfoundation.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and in each of our in-depth climate casts, we like to take you out into the field with the scientists who are doing the work. Today, we're headed to Germany, where Andrea Milan studies human migration as a result of climate change. He's a research assistant at United Nations University, and he's with us today from Bonn, Germany. Andrea, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Are you visiting places where people are being affected right now by the consequences of climate change? And what are they telling you about what's happening?
Yeah, you know, I was listening to Michael Mann earlier talking about climate change presented as an abstract entity that is far away from us. And that's exactly what we try to avoid by bringing experiences from the field. I've been recently to the Pacific, to several small countries, Kiribati, Nauru, Tuvalu. And those countries are places in which you can definitely see with your eyes what's going on right now on the field with climatic stressors. It's, of course, hard to link climate change to any specific event at one specific point in time, but what we do know is that the climate extremes that we see in the Pacific are an analogy for what might happen more often in the future in many more places in the world. Now, when you go to a place like Kiribati, you're living in you go in a very small strip of land in between a huge ocean and a very big lagoon on the other side, and you're on a very low lying, with the highest point being possibly 1 meter above sea level. You're on a very low lying, very narrow strip of land, and I've experienced myself a king tide, which is basically a moment in which the waves really come into the land. So when you're in a place like that, you really see that human face of climate change that Michael was talking about earlier.
I understand that there are places that you go into where the community, the village, the larger communities are saying, we may just have to pick up and abandon this place and move somewhere else. I mean, what role do you play when you listen in on those discussions?
Well, you know, there are two sides of the answer. On the one hand, we want to create, to allow people to live sustainably where they are whenever it's possible. However, we also know that in certain cases, climate change might make, and is already making probably in certain parts of the world, certain areas, certain livelihoods unsustainable. People cannot live there anymore. And in that case, our aim is to provide people in cooperation with governments, because we always, of course, work with governments. We want to provide people with options to pursue labor or student migration as a strategy for them to maximize their incomes. And in certain cases, also to manage their risks at the household level, because what you see very often is that households send, for example, one migrant to the nearby urban area to diversify their risks, because they know that if anything happens in the rural community, remittances maybe from their household member in the city will keep coming, because of course the urban area might not be affected by the same stressors. So there are two sides, allowing people to stay whenever possible, and if not, we want migration to be successful.
You know what's interesting about this, Andrea? Well, you're describing that, I'm thinking there are plenty of people in the world, especially here in the United States, that live in areas where we've gotten all kinds of signals that climate change is going to make a big impact there. It may not be sustainable, right, to stay on the coast or to stay in, you know, at some areas of New Orleans. And there's so much resistance to that in this country. Do you see that in other places?
You have different levels of attachment to place, so to say. And this is one
of
the great challenges of effective migration policies. In certain cases, for example, you have the need for planned relocations because places, as you say, might become uninhabitable. And of course, there's an interest in having participatory processes as far as possible. But there is very often a resistance due to the fact that we as humans tend to only somehow believe in the severity of a threat in the moment in which we face it. It's really hard to communicate to people climatic risk unless they really face it with their eyes. And so this is one of the big challenges and one of the areas in which I think we as the UN University have a big role to play in bridging, you know, the knowledge that comes from the academic world with the policy making that is done at the local level and the regional and national level where these measures can be implemented.
You've been to Bangladesh, right?
For a short period, yes, it was.
I mean, isn't that a country that has really been devastated by some of the consequences of climate change? And some of the places in that country are going to be uninhabitable as a result.
Yes, we have. We were currently working on a 5 years long project in Bangladesh. It's definitely the country that is probably most often cited on climate change because they are exposed to all sorts of climatic stressors. So yes, this is luckily it's also one of the countries in which the government is most active in trying to address all of those issues. So. I'm confident that the population in Bangladesh is very resilient and that they will be able to deal successfully, to cope with the climatic issues that they have. And of course, they might need the help from the international community. And this is one of the things that will be debated, you know, in the upcoming climate negotiations, which are going to take place in Paris and in which, you know, different aspects of climate change will be debated, including, of course, what type of support will come from so to say Western countries to help countries like Bangladesh adapt with climatic changes as well as with the losses and damages that they might incur as a result of climate change.
You know, that's something I was curious about is whether human migration will be part of the discussion in Paris, or is it really going to be more based on, I don't know, the most urgent changes that are taking place because of climate change and getting big countries to respond to that?
Yeah, this is one of those things that we will only know at the very last minute because there are negotiations. The human migration was in an earlier draft of the text, is not on the current draft of the text, but you know things get in and get out of the text, so we will never really know until the very last minute. But human mobility in general is recognized within the climate change, the internationally agreed climate change texts. It's mentioned both in the Cancun Adaptation Framework, which is, so to say, the most a very important text that has been agreed upon regarding adaptation. And it's also in the text that has been agreed in Doha regarding loss and damage that occur as an effect of the adverse impact of climate change. So human mobility is already in there. So far, it's been mostly in terms of countries agreeing on the need to enhance our understanding of the relationship between climate change and human mobility. So we will see whether in Paris the text will, so to say, renew this commitment or whether there will be even more there will be a text that will be even more oriented towards more practical solutions.
Last question here, and if you were listening into the discussion with Michael Mann, you might have heard him talking about Syria. You know, as I read what the analysts say about what was happening in Syria, and I think he fleshed that out a little bit, an unprecedented drought between 2006 and 2011, a lot of people leaving the agricultural areas and going into the cities. And then we see what happens when you put conflict, armed conflict, into the middle of that. How do you view it, given your study of human migration?
Well, you know, migration is always a very complex migration decision-making is always very complex. And climatic factors definitely do play a role. It's very hard to say, you know, to what extent, you know, climatic issues like drought determine migration decision-making. But what is clear, of course, is especially in areas where people depend on subsistence, agriculture, or any sort of primary activity, climatic and environmental conditions do play an important role in their livelihoods. And, of course, their migration decision-making is based on their conditions in situ where they are, so in the place where they are, and they're often compared to what can expect the potential migrant in the area of destination that they identify, and then migration decision making is based on those considerations. So it's really hard to say to what extent climatic considerations determine mobility decisions, but definitely they do influence them.
Andrea, I really appreciate the time and giving us a glimpse into the work that you do on human migration and climate change. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Andrea Milan is a research assistant at United Nations University, and he was with us from Bonn, Germany. See, that's the interesting thing, Paul, about studying what has happened in Syria. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time that that drought began in 2006, there probably were some policymakers who said, and what if you added armed conflict into that? But there was probably an unawareness of what happens when you mix those two things and you get the kind of flammable situation that we have today.
Well, and that's what the national security community is looking at. What are these tipping points? How much is enough to drive a region from stress into conflict and migration? And there are other areas of the world that they're watching. They've put out reports on this. Sea level rise is another factor. So these things kind of go slow motion until they don't.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden it's a catastrophe.
Give me a sense of some of the other climate news that you're keeping track of this
Three
week.
Main stories I'm watching this week. NASA coming out yesterday saying a 93% chance now that 2015 will be the warmest year on record globally. The new warmest year. Of course, last year we know was the warmest year. NOAA says 97%. So far, it's the hottest year in the western U.S. on record. 19th warmest year in Minnesota so far. It's been a little cooler in the eastern half of the country. So that's one. Two, the Super El Nino. We touched on it with Michael Mann. It's now being called too big to fail by scientists at NASA.
What does that mean? That it is going to happen?
It's so prevalent now, and the temperatures are so warm that they're rivaling that 97-98 event. This thing is locked in for the winter. So it looks like we're going to have an event that challenges the El Nino of record, which was in 1997-98. And that, of course, is getting a lot of attention. As I pointed out, Minnesota, that favors a milder than average winter with less snow than normal. And then finally, and this goes to sort of what Andrea was talking about, Climate Central has a project called Surging Seas, where they have analyzed 414 U.S. coastal cities. They've calculated we've already locked in 5 feet of sea level rise. That's what with the current emissions that are already in the atmosphere. And if you look at the population from those cities, most of the population lives within 5 feet of the current high tide line. Example, carry Miami. The projections, 50% of people in the city could be underwater by 2050.
Oh, my gosh.
If left unchecked with greenhouse emissions. So there are some U.S. cities that are particularly vulnerable to these small sea level rises.
I think at some point, Paul, we ought to talk to somebody in Miami for a climate cast.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is urgent.
It's happening now. It's a porous landscape, so the water bubbles up from underneath. They get these king tides. We should do that. That's a great topic.
All right, good. Hey, good to see you. Thanks very much.
And always you too. Thanks, Carrie.
That is our in-depth climate cast for the month, and we'll do another one next month. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to talk about why millennials are spending mortgage-sized lumps of money on their weddings. Why is that? We're also going to go live to President Obama as he makes remarks about Afghanistan and troop levels. That's all ahead in the next hour. Stay with us.